Welcome to episode number 45, Music to My Ears.
This is the Rotated Views Podcast with Jimmy Lee and the crew, giving you life from various perspectives. Welcome to our level. We hope you enjoy the views.
All right, you're now tuned into the Rotated Views Podcast. I am your host, Jimmy Lee Velez. I am here in the studio with Heck, Gabe, and special guest Eric Harris DeFarina. That's right, baby.
What's up, baby? Guys?
Music to my ears. In this episode, we have special guest producer, writer Eric Harris, aka DeFarina. We discuss the music business slash industry, music from the 90s, the importance of having good lyrical content, producing music, the new era versus the old era, our favorite 90s artist, and advice for someone just getting started in the music industry. We wrap the episodes up appropriately with quotes from the notorious B.I.G. and Tupac Shakur. So, how I like to kick things off with the dictionary.com definition, and of course, we define hip-hop. They define it as the popular subculture of big city teenagers, which includes rap music, breakdancing, and graffiti art. That reminds me of that, what was that movie that you, Breaker, or Breaking?
Breaking?
Breaking.
Yeah, but what was the other one, Eric, with the graffiti?
Beat Street.
Yeah. That's what that reminds me of, with these dudes with the hanging little earrings and the Jerry Curl juice.
Nah, that's Breaking.
Oh,
Beat
that's Breaking.
Beat Street is more of the graffiti, the artwork, and tagging, and all that stuff. That's Beat Street, but they dance too.
And then there's also Wild Style.
Wow,
that goes back even further than B Street.
Really? So was that 80s or late 70s?
Probably like mid 80s, probably earlier actually. And it has that was probably one of the first features of the Rocksteady Crew.
Oh man,
wow!
And it's called, what is it called?
Wild Style.
I'm gonna have to look that one up.
I'm writing that down. Actually.
Yeah, that's definitely I think we look. I tried to look that one up before at work. You told me about that.
Yeah, we probably looked it up.
Yeah,
it's difficult. It's kind of difficult to find in a good quality, I guess. I should say.
All right. Yeah.
All right. So this week's story I grabbed from notalwaysright.com, and it's titled "Stupidity Amplified." So the person goes, I work for an online music store and often customers call if they have any sort of problem with an order. The caller, I purchased a very expensive amplifier head from your company. I am thinking about sending it back because it cuts in and out with sounds while I'm playing my guitar through it. I boxed it up and set it on my porch 2 nights ago, but no one has come picked it up. Me, when did you call us for a return authorization? Caller, I didn't. Why wouldn't someone just come pick it up? So that's beyond
stupid. Like, what? What possessed you to think someone's gonna take that?
Someone just magically knows to come pick
it. Right, but then had someone taken it, he's thinking it's getting returned, and really somebody stole it. He would have been completely out of it.
I brought that into this episode to bring into perspective that we often catch ourselves being so into our own little worlds that we think that everything and everyone, you know, revolves around us. I'm not saying everyone's like that, but every once in a while we kind of think that, you know, the world is ours and everything should go around us. But the reason why I say that with this episode is because when it comes to music, I've entered into several hundred conversations about the most, I guess, I don't even know how to explain it, opinionated statements ever made, and people think that what they say, and myself included, is factual or is the utmost respectable comments ever made. And you talk to, I mean, this goes beyond music, right? You go to, you know, like even cars. Oh, man, they don't make cars like they do back in the day. Movies. Oh, they don't make movies like they do back in the day.
Taste is purely subjective.
Exactly. And that's the point. So if we can have an open mind when we're having music conversations or conversations about anything, I think it's good for everybody, whether you're the speaker or the listener.
Yes.
We can definitely learn something. And today we already learned something. I'm going to go download the Wild style movie from the early 80s. So today we have Eric Harris with us, aka DeFarna, and I am fascinated by this because the 90s era of music is not completely the foundation. I would say it was like the launching pad because it set hip hop up into a whole other stratosphere. Obviously the 70s and 80s was the foundation, what set everything up. And this is where hip hop, I believe, hip hop took off and actually got respected, and people, you know, they're getting awards for stuff. I mean, it is just fascinating stuff. So, yes. Let's kick it off. Eric, let's get a little bit about you. Who is Eric? And give us a little bit of background about yourself, including your nationality and how you got started in the music industry.
All right. Eric Harris. I am originally from Panama, Panama City, Panama, Central America. And I'm going to talk like you guys don't know. You may know a lot, but I'm going to go back and just talk as if I'm talking to someone that doesn't know much about my background of music or music, period.
Perfect.
In Panama City, Panama, being that we have the canal, you get people from throughout the world. There used to be a lot of U.S. soldiers stationed in the canal.
Yeah.
So with the soldiers, there was American music. There was rock and roll. There was R&B. I mean, you name it. It was brought to Panama. So it was, musically, it was somewhat as us being in the United States.
Right.
You know, then not just the U.S. soldiers, but you also had all sorts of people migrate to Panama to get jobs, because the Panama Canal was, I mean, it still is, millions and millions of dollars a day business. Okay. So people will come from Jamaica, Trinidad. So that's already reggae. That's soca, calypso music. So we have such a broad style of music, or just our mentality is totally different, that I feel safe to say, than the rest of the world, because we have it all there in such a small city.
Right.
So that's basically how it started for me, was just basically listening to all sorts of styles. Then coming to the United States, I'm going to date myself, but listening to Rapper's Delight and things like that, and just really liking it and knowing that that was something that I wanted to be a part of. So I guess what I'm trying to get at, it's that's kind of like who I am. I'm still today, I am hip hop. I still listen to it today, not as much as I used to, but that's pretty much who I am. I'm hip hop to the core.
So Panama is really like, so when you grew up, where you grew up is kind of like the hub of all different kinds of music, because currently, the internet, we have access to all kinds of music. But what
yes.
you experienced was the real true definition of like a melting pot of music. And it was all
yes.
just kind of, I guess, giving birth to all new kinds and new forms, and exposing you really to these different forms of music, and basically it generated its own style, I'm assuming?
Yes. Not just, well, I guess somewhat. And Like say reggae,
right.
Spanish reggae, then came reggaeton, you know. Then you have soca music in Trinidad. We have like Spanish soca. We kind of like flipped it. Basically, the language, the music was the same, maybe slightly different, with more of a mixture of kind of like what you guys have in Puerto Rico and what we have in Panama, like a blend.
Yeah.
You know, but Spanish.
Yeah. So you're saying so the beat was the same, but obviously you did it in a Spanish way. So whatever they brought to Panama, you kind of just made it your own. Really.
Yeah, sort of like, we either did that or made a fusion of it, you know.
Like mix two different things together to make one?
Yes, exactly. You know.
So from there, all right, so we move from... You know, that was kind of like the introductory portion of your life to, you know, the different kinds of music, and what an amazing place to be especially for someone like yourself who's intrigued and talented musically. Wow, that's crazy. So was there a major artist or a group of guys that were older than you maybe that you kind of looked up to and kind of followed, or was this something that you're of age and you kind of just took on yourself? How'd that go?
Back in Panama, I've always listened to, we listened to all kinds of music, but as far as someone that I admire lyrically was Rubén Blades, which did a lot of stuff with Willie Colón, after Héctor Lavoe, kind of like, I don't want to say faded, because he's like, to me, he's one of the greatest, Héctor Lavoe, with salsa music.
Yeah.
But kind of like after his peak, Rubén Blades came in and brought a lot of different styles of lyrics. And he worked with, closely with Willie Colón and Fania music. And I really admire his style, because lyrically, he brought something more than just party lyrics.
Yeah.
Lyrically, it was like a conscious thing. Yeah. He brought songs like Pedro Navaja, things that you can kind of picture.
Yeah.
Instead of just, I'm going to party, it was more like, man, I can see what he's saying.
You got the visual of what he was saying.
So I kind of like that. And that kind of brought me along into the late 80s and 90s with styles like KRS-One, where they just not rapping, they telling you something.
Yeah.
Like Slick Rick, always like a storyteller.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of like getting ahead of myself, but lyrically, that's what I like. I like someone that can write and tell you something, not just, everybody say, oh, party over here.
Yeah. Some with deeper meaning.
Yeah, it's like you're writing. Yeah, exactly. Thank you.
No, I totally understand that. And there is a time and place for the party stuff, but there comes a time where it's like, I want some depth to what you're saying.
Yes, it's cool to do the party stuff, but
sure.
You can't go on forever with that.
No, exactly.
We got to enlighten the mind of the kids today.
Yeah.
It's like, if I come to my home to see my kid, and I'm always, and all I'm doing is, let's say I'm constantly singing or rapping about parties, that's all my kids are going to get.
Yeah. Right.
Same goes with a kid outside of the household or elsewhere. If I'm not kicking knowledge, he's not going to get knowledge. He's just going to get whatever I'm saying, whether I'm talking about or whatever. That's all he's going to get.
He's not going to
get anything else,
Yeah, no, I totally get that. And it's beyond just the experience. It's learning something. And actually, it could be whether you're learning something that's motivating or even understanding someone's story, that people have been through things and they've experienced life differently than you had. And what always amazes me is that someone can not only express their story in this way, but really get into details and kind of how you're saying is say in a story. When someone says it in a story and it makes sense and it's musically altogether somehow in a genius way is put together, it's seriously like it's mind blowing. Yeah, but it arouses your thought process and it gets you to think in a deeper way and it's kind of like what you're saying. There's a message there.
Yeah.
There's content. Yeah. There's depth. It's not just a shallow surface of someone throwing money in the air or whatever level of ignorance you want to get to. And not about killing or none of that. There's experiences that people have gone through and they're explaining it this way, man, there's nothing better than just sitting back and vibing with that person. And you just, even especially like you're in a car by yourself, just cruising, like, oh my gosh, there's nothing better. But you took it to a different, so I'm not, I'm a writer, right? But I'm not a songwriter. So there's a difference.
What is,
so you went from finding out this music and, you grew up with it, and then you're finding new artists that are, getting you to think a certain way and a different way and open you up to this really deeper sense of music that where did you go from there? Did you just start writing? Did you just start making beats? How did the writing aspect come in? Well, and then when did the producing come in?
So let me go back a little bit. I started, obviously you love music first, then you start going through your daddy's records. You know, your father's like, don't touch my records, whatever. So I start going through his records. I start DJing. So now in Washington, D.C., in the mid-80s, I'm DJing. I'm meeting a lot of people in the music industry, and I end up at a studio of this guy named Von Mason. Von Mason is actually the guy that did Bounce Rock Skate Roll. I don't know if you guys know that, but that's like a famous skating rink song. And I was obvious, I was in awe because this guy was kind of big back then, and here I am in his studio. Yeah. Now, the first thing that I learned in that studio was how to edit. And the way that they edited back then was slicing tape. Yeah. It wasn't like today, like everything is digital. Right. You literally had to take the tape and you wiggle it around the head so you could hear the sound where the bass starts, and then you have to slice it. And then you may have to record and record and record and slice. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So
that's where cut and paste came from that we see on the computer.
Gotcha.
Basically, we were cutting and pasting literally
crazy.
The tape. Not you know, it wasn't done digitally. So from there, you know, I started liking it, obviously. And I started with a couple of friends from high school. We decided to build our own studio. From there, that's kind of, I was recording a lot of artists. I was recording a lot of Jamaican artists back in DC. I was recording, you guys probably know this guy. I recorded Notch. Notch is, the American Jamaican artist from a group called Born Jamaican. Yeah. I started recording him along with other artists in DC. At the time, one of my friends was working at BET, so a lot of the, I don't know if you guys remember, before the BET basement?
Yeah.
BET was doing a lot of their recordings outside, different studios. So they would choose my studio, being that BET main office was in DC, and I was in DC. My friend would ask me, can I use your studio? Gangstar is coming in town. So I will have Guru here. Yeah, Guru, DJ Premier will be in my studio, you know, doing their session. And then after that, we would talk, we would vibe, kind of like what we're doing now.
Yeah.
And I will get inspired by some of the things they would say, you know, and maybe write or maybe do whatever. Sometimes they will have guys like Biz Markie. I've seen so many faces come in and out. Mellow Man Ace, who's the brother of Sen Dog from Cypress Hill.
Okay.
We will have a lot of people like that. So just, I guess, by me seeing these cats, hearing their music or watching their videos, I will get a lot of inspiration. You know, one of the things that you mentioned a minute ago about our style of writing being different, because I write for music and you write maybe for a book writer, maybe.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. Well, it's pretty much the same, because you're writing to wow people or to make people go, wow, I didn't think about that.
Yeah.
To inspire people.
Yeah.
So really it is the same, only I have to make it melodic. And
right, yeah.
You don't have to stay on beat while you're writing your book. You know what I'm saying?
That's probably
one of the only differences, but probably the same creative process.
That's awesome, because when you said that you're in the studio, and you know, there's people coming in and out, and you're just kind of getting inspired, even whether it's, you know, a conversation that you're having with them, or just listening to the music, or just seeing them come through and just getting motivated by them saying, you know, this is possible, like. At one point, you know, I could, you know, possibly be, you know, as big as this person, and, you know, video, you know, crew is following me around. I kind of do the same thing when I'm reading a book or watching a YouTube video or something. I just get inspired and I just jump on my a lot of the stuff is on my phone just because it's the fastest thing to get to. But if not, I have my laptop out there. But it is true. I feel like you cannot force inspiration. So when it comes to you, you have to jot it down. I know there's, we'll get to this, but there are stories that Heck told me, like music that you made. And he's like, yo, he made this on a car ride home or made up these lyrics on the car ride home or something from work. And it was just like fascinating to me because when I get, feedback from my book or, the content on my blog or whatever it is, people are like, well, where are you getting your material from? Like, how do you come up with your material? And I'm like, it's almost like a little lightning bolt, like a flash of, like a little thought that comes and you have to capture it. You have to harness it at that moment, or at least relatively close to that moment, just so you don't lose it. And the reason the reason being is because you're not going to be as passionate or as creative 10 hours later, 20 hours later, when you're like, oh yeah, that one thought that I had, let me just write it down. When it comes to you, act on it, right?
Exactly. Yeah, that it's kind of like what you just said, and you probably agree with me. The one thought can lead to a whole page.
Yes.
But if you don't write that one thought down, you can forget it. Later on, you're gonna be like, man, what was that? And I know it was nice. I know it was dope, but I forgot what it was.
Yeah.
So you're right. It's like you gotta write it. You gotta take it at that moment because that one or two lines can lead to a whole verse or to a whole book of a whole page of a book. Yeah. So that's a great point.
The other tool that I use on my phone is the recorder. Because then you get like sometimes, like I said, it happens when you're driving. I'm like, oh no. Yeah. So I'm like fumbling my phone, trying to get to the recorder, praying for a red light. So I get to the red light, set up the recorder, bink. As soon as I hit that on, I'm good. Cause now I could just talk. But, that is true. If you don't capture it, it's not the same, or you forget. And by the time I get to work, I'm like, man, what in the world was I trying to say?
Yeah, exactly.
All right, so where do you go from here? So now you have, the whole studio thing's going crazy. You're DJing and you're in Washington D.C. and you start to create all these connections. Now where did the name The Foreigner come from? Was that developed during that time?
Well, The Foreigner actually came a little later. At this time, I'm actually a DJ, like in D.C. I'm not even going as a producer. I'm still going by like DJ Swift was what they used to call me.
Okay.
So, but also during this time where we had the studio, Howard University is right down the street from me. And Puff, Sean Daddy Combe, Puff Daddy, whatever you want to call him, he is at Howard University right now. So I'm watching, the way he back then, obviously promoting was totally different than what it is today because we didn't have Facebook, we didn't have Instagram or any of that.
Yeah.
So he would walk around Howard University with a whole bunch of cats with signs that say Bad Boy coming soon. Wow. Bad Boy Entertainment coming soon. And I'm like, Bad Boy Entertainment. But we know these cats because they throw parties. Like Heavy D used to come down to D.C. and throw parties with Sean Puffy Combs.
Oh, okay.
So, we're like, yo, what's this? Or whatever. We had a lot of connections with New York, so a lot of cats will bring CDs or tapes down and be like, check this out. So, actually, I was talking to Heck about this earlier. I was listening to Biggie's first album. I was listening to it on tape.
Wow.
And some of the songs are the same, only they had different titles.
Oh, okay.
So before Biggie even came out, we used to be in the studio like, man, that dude is nice. We had no idea that he was a big fat guy or whatever. We just know this dude is nice.
Yeah.
And we couldn't wait to see him. Or we would pick up like the Source magazine. I don't know if you guys know about the Source magazine.
Oh yeah,
it was back then. But the Source had the column where they would take an artist and and give them like three mics, four mics, depending on how dope they were. So
that's
from hearing Biggie and then seeing him on the Source magazine, we were like, wow, this dude is going to be big. And then you hear, it was all a dream. I used to read Word Up magazine. And I was like, that voice, I was like, yo, this dude, he's, you know, he's going to knock it out the park.
Yeah.
It was like, that's all it took. And, you know, that's how it is with certain artists. You just take that little bit to hear and you're like, that kid's going to be nice.
Yeah.
You know, and that's how we were listening to Biggie. So at this point, I'm just kicking beats in and out, just doing beats in and out. I'm not a family man. I'm single.
Yeah.
So I'm in the studio. I'm in the studio day and night. So I met this this dude named Pierre. They call him Pete. Pete is from Haiti, but he grew up in Brooklyn, and he would always come around the studio. He was like, yo, I'm going to introduce you to some of my friends in New York. And he would say this every time he walked in the studio. I'm gonna introduce you to my boys in New York. So one day he's like, pack your keyboard, because my keyboard is actually the same keyboard I have today. It's like a sampling station where you could pretty much do everything on it. Wu-Tang actually recorded the first album with the same style keyboard.
Wow.
So he told me, pack your keyboard, we're going to Brooklyn. So I was like, cool. You know, pack my keyboard, we're going to Brooklyn. I packed my keyboard. And from the moment I left D.C. to New York, within a span of 2 years, I've met Biggie, I met Supercat, you know, I was in and out of, you know, hanging with people like Sean Puffy Combs, I met P-Rock and CL Smooth, you know, I got to, got kind of close with Heavy D, where Heavy D was listening to some of my songs in like Spanish or bilingual songs.
Yeah.
And be like, yo, I'm going to take you up to Universal. I'm going to have Universal sign you, you know, stuff like that. So,
so dope.
So we had people like Universal, Sony, Latin, I think at the moment, I can't remember which was the top Latin a record label, but there was like a branch of, let's say, Sony and Latin Sony.
Okay.
And so some of these cats were looking at me. To me, it was very early. It was very early. I'm sure they weren't just looking at me. They were probably looking at other artists also.
Right.
I ran into a guy named Little Indian, who was also hanging around that clique. Now, I'm talking about people like Busta Rhymes. You know, people like that. This was obviously they were younger.
Yeah.
And there was no man, that's Busta Rhymes. Oh man, it was like we chill, and don't act like a Martian.
Yeah.
Just act. These are people just like you and I. And that's how we were. So this dude, Indian, Little Indian, who's like today he's, you know, a pretty cool cat. He gave me a big break. I consider him like my brother. He told me he wanted to write a song with me because we used to get, you know, we used to vibe and everybody kick a verse here and there. So he was like, yeah, I want to write a song with you. So I'm like, cool, you know, just let me know when. So one morning while I'm in Brooklyn, he wakes me up. He's like, yo, and I'm saying he wakes me up because we will sleep. We will go to sleep like at 4 or 5 in the morning.
Yeah.
If you know musicians and you know any studio musician, this is the time, you know, you go to bed and then you sleep till noon and then you wake up. This dude woke me up like at 8 in the morning. And he was like, come to the studio. We got this song we want to do. He was already working on the album for Warner Brothers. And I jumped on a cab. I went to the studio. The studio is actually... you guys may not know Howie T. Howie T produced the real Roxanne. He did Dougie Fresh. He produced Chubb Rock. A lot of people were in and out of that studio. So when I got to that studio, I was like, wow, you know, it's Howie T. This dude is big.
Yeah.
So he tells me to go in the sound booth. They play the song. And after I hear the song, maybe 10, 15 minutes later, I lay my verse down. The song is called One Little Indian. And the song, they like the song so much that they happen to put it out as a first single.
Oh, wow.
For this is, which was like, was unexpected for me. You know, I'm expecting to be on this guy's album, not to be on his first single.
Right, right.
So, you know, we shoot a video, we do everything. We do a East Coast tour for the song. We end up, you name it, from north to south, we're all over the place with the song. And it kind of like opened the way a little, I guess a little more for what was happening earlier with Warner Brothers and these other labels.
Yeah.
So now labels were actually paying attention.
Right.
To who I was.
So how old were you at this time?
Ooh, I was, around that time I was like 23, 24.
So when you went from DC to New York, you're about 23 years old?
Yeah, 22, 24 years old.
Okay.
So anyway, so, we do the song, you know, we end up doing a lot of small tours here and there.
Right.
Opening for people like Usher. This is Usher when Usher first came out.
Wow.
His first Usher, crazy. Like Monica, you know, people like Usher, Monica, kind of like anybody that was around during that time. The Lost Boys, Naughty by Nature. You know, groups like that. So
let me ask you something. So you put this song together. You laid your verse down. It's titled One Little Indian. Mm-hmm. You and this other guy are touring back and forth. I want to ask you a question about the actual performing. Now, mm-hmm. did you get an adrenaline rush just as much from the performance? Because I know a lot of people are like, there's ghostwriters out there who can write their butts off and they're very talented, you know, musically inclined, but they don't want to perform for nothing. They don't want to be in the, you know, in the forefront, so to speak, front and center.
Yeah.
How was that experience? Did you naturally transition to it? Did you that's what you wanted to do, or you kind of just were just doing it just because?
It's actually kind of like always been that way for me.
Yeah.
Because I really never wanted to be up front.
Right.
You know, I was always a DJ. I was a producer. And then after people left the studio, I would challenge myself to write something better than what they just did.
Gotcha.
You know what I mean? So that's something that I kind of like always did. But I never wanted to be on stage, really.
Yeah.
But when I was on stage, I you get a little nervous. You get a little nervous. But the moment you step on stage, I was never nervous.
Right.
Like, that feeling went away. The moment I step on stage, it's gone. I don't know what it is, but when you're backstage, you know, butterflies, you hear the crowd, you hear the people, whatever, or you just hear the person announcing that you're about to go on stage, and you want to rush to the bathroom at that moment. But once you're on stage, it's all gone. At least for me, it is. And I talked to other guys that you know, that have more experience on stage than I do, and they tell me the same thing. They tell me you get a little nervous, and once you're on, you're on. And then, you know, everything goes out the window.
There's a, for anyone out there that's, you know, wants to kind of relate to what Eric is saying right now, there's a video on YouTube. You have to look this up. If that kind of even interests you, or if this happens to you, whether you're a public speaker or you're an artist, like Eric going up on stage for the first time, there is... or you're just a competitor in general, and you get that, you know, the butterflies in your stomach right before, you know, it's all about to go down, so to speak. There's a video of Mike Tyson explaining his entrance into the ring up until his actual fight. It is, I mean, I guarantee you're going to get chills. It is like jaw dropping because he puts you into his mind.
He's explaining what's going on through his head as he's walking out.
So like he's. And I'm going to completely, you know, not do this just, you know, justice, but I'll kind of explain. So he's in the back getting, you know, getting warmed up and getting dressed up. So he's like, what in the, so he's explaining his thought process. He's like, what in the world am I doing? Why did I get into this? Why did I challenge this guy? Mm-hmm. And then boom, they show him like they're like taping up his hands. He's like, this dude's gonna knock me out. What am I doing? This guy's bigger than me. He's like, oh my God, this dude's gonna eat me alive. And he has all these doubts that are going through his mind. Then boom, he's dressed up. He puts the hood on and he's like, come on, Mike, what are you talking about? Come on, you could do this. Come on, buddy. Whatever. So he keeps explaining it. And now all of a sudden he sees the crowd go crazy when he walks into the thing. He's like, oh man, now you're stuck. You can't run back now. So now he's like, boom, you're at full commitment at this point. So then he goes, there's no running back or whatever. So now he's like, then you jump up on the three steps leading to it. He's like, oh man, it's go time. That's it, Mike. Now you got to fight this guy. And he says, when he gets into the ring, he goes, boom, that's it. This guy's dead. He's mine. I'm a god. No one could touch me. And dude, he's like, I'm an immortal. Dude, his explanation will freaking blow your mind. Do I get the chill saying it? And I had a terrible version of that, that story.
But he goes through the whole range of emotions.
Yes, he goes through the whole range of emotions. He's like, my eyes are watering up. Just like, I just want to kill this guy. And it's insane, but it's the same kind of like what you're talking about. It's like, you have all these doubts, you're nervous, because you just don't, I always explain is like, you just don't want to mess up. You're given an opportunity, you just don't want to mess it up. That's all. People are like, well, what are you nervous about? You know what you're doing? Yeah, you do know what you're doing.
You want to let people down.
You just don't want to let people down. You don't want to mess it up. That's all and that's natural. I feel like if you don't have that, there's something wrong. Or you're taking it for granted or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
All right, so let's go on. So the performance kind of thing was, you just did it just because that was part of, you're just jumping on the opportunity, really.
Yep, well, I love it. Yeah. Like, it's something that I love music, so, and I was doing it, like, off and on. Like, some of my friends, we would go to open mic in D.C., and I wasn't a rapper, but I would go to open mic night, and we would rock, and people would be like, well, he's a DJ,
right?
You know? And then, I've been in a lot of situations where people will look at me and it'll be like a cipher going on. And people don't expect me to spit what comes out of my mouth.
Right, they're like,
wait a minute, but then if I do it in Spanish and English, even worse. Because they're like, but you're black. So, it's like you really throw them off then. So, but it's just something that I really enjoy, and I'm very thankful. Like, I don't know if I ever mentioned this to Hector, but I always thank God when I write something, because I truly don't think it's just me. It's like some of the stuff that I write, I listen to myself or I read it, and I'm like, I didn't write that.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
It's yeah.
Like the inspiration was at some level that you were not at that level on your own.
Yes,
something just took over.
I'm so thankful to God, man, for some of the things that I've written in the past.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean, because sometimes you read back, or someone's reading back to like, I read some of your book or whatever, some of your posts. You said blah, blah, blah. I'm like, and I'm looking at them. I was like, I did not write that. I'm like, yo, I wrote that? I'm like, dang, that's pretty good. Yeah. But it's true. It's one of those things. I feel like, and we talk about this all the time. If you have any interest in this topic, look up what a mastermind is. And this is what happens, I believe. When you pour in your all into something at some level and at some point, I just believe God intervenes and helps you out and goes, and there's just like, there's a little electric bolt that is throwing these little sparks of genius into your mind, and boom, it just hits you and you're just boom. And you stand back, you're like, I wrote that? I'm like, what in the world? How'd that happen? I just feel like that comes to people who are very passionate about something, and those sparks of genius happen because of that level of interaction. Let's move on from here. So where are you at now? Are you in now? So now you live in New York.
Yeah.
You're a DJ and a producer at this point.
I'm in New York. I'm going into studios with, at times we're coming up and down from DC. I'm coming up with I was in a group called D2E Down to Earth, which was made up of myself, this kid from Jamaica and a kid from Philly. So if you can imagine, the kid from Philly, he's amazing. He's a great writer. And the guy from Jamaica, just had a like a patois style, kind of like a bujubantam, but kind of like a lighter voice, not so rough.
Okay. Yeah.
And then me, I could do Spanish or English, go back and forth. So you hear, when you heard our songs, there was like so much in the song because of our styles were different.
Yeah.
Right. Kind of like Fushnecken style.
Yeah, sort of. The Fushneckens.
Yeah. You know, so we would go up and down to New York at times. Firehouse Studio was one of the studios that I remember because that's where Wu-Tang recorded 36 Chambers.
Wow.
So we were going to this studio. We would record with this engineer named Carlos Best. And Carlos was the engineer for Wu-Tang back then, too.
Wow.
So, that's dope. You know, I remember one day walking in the studio and I saw RZA.
Huh.
And I'm looking for this output expander for my ASR-10, which is my keyboard. And the output expander is sort of like to send the bass here, send the snare there. You know, it splits everything instead of just having it left and right.
Oh, okay.
And RZA happened to be the only one that had one. So he like, yo, man, I'm getting ready to go to L.A. So you can hold on to it, man. No big deal. You know, you can use it anytime you want. If Carlos here, Carlos can lend it to you. So I'm like, this is RZA.
Mad chill, yeah.
And he's talking to me like we cool.
Right,
you know?
Right.
So he's cool about me using the material, using the stuff that they have in the studio. Another day that I remember was walking in the studio, and at the moment I walk in, there's a notebook, and the notebook says Method Man right in the front of it.
Wow.
And I'm curious. I'm like, wow, Method Man. So I opened it, and you can read it, but you don't know how to say it.
Yeah.
Method Man is like, there's no way you're going to copy Method Man, his style. Yeah. So I'm looking at the book. I'm like, wow, man, Method Man's book. So I was like, Carlos, Method Man left his book over here. And I handed it to him, like, man, because they were in California at the time. And he's like, man, you know how many people would have grabbed that book and jet it with it? And I'm like, I don't know why. There's nothing you can do with it if you don't know how to say it.
Yeah.
What are you going to do with the book? You know, I understand if it was, let's say, something you would have written and it's just for a book.
Right.
But if it's for a song, there's no way in the world Hector is going to write a song and I'm going to just grab it with no melody behind it and do it exactly the way he did it.
Yeah.
He had no idea. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like Meth, it's too much flavor to him. So it's just, that's one of the crazy things that happened. It's like,
so this studio, man, there's a lot of, obviously a lot of activity going around. This is where, we're in New York at this point, and it got, you know, the mecca of hip hop. Basically, that's where it all, you know, it came from. And where did you guys have to pay for studio time? 'Cause I know that's like a big thing. Like, there's so many people that I hear like that they have studio time. I don't know how it was back then, or I'll have you explain it, but it's so expensive that nowadays that these dudes have to have everything prepared. Like they don't eat when they're there. They don't do none. So they eat before they go. They have a bunch of waters around with them. They have all their stuff like literally ready to go. So the second you walk in the door, your time starts.
Getting out of business.
Yeah. Like you have the studio for 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours, whatever. You have a blocks of time. I mean, the wealthier people are like, we have it for a whole week.
Yeah.
But if you're just starting and you don't have money and you can only afford 2 hours, you better get your money's worth. You ain't eating. You ain't going to the bathroom, nothing. Dude, people just literally walk up to the mic check, sound check, do whatever, and they just start recording. And they're like, we'll add the beat on or whatever later. We'll, you know, do the mixing. How'd that work out for you guys?
When I was recording an artist, my fees were like $40-$50 an hour. And you never tell the artist, like, come prepare it. You tell him he can do whatever he wants. That's his time.
Yeah.
But then when I started going to studios, like in New York, like, say it was like $75 an hour.
Yeah.
Or it'll be like, you can block it. You can block 3 hours, 4 hours for, let's say, $250. It was some kind of deal like that.
Right.
You know. But we were ready. We were like, we know the song we're going to do, and we know the lyrics. and we know everything. We're not gonna go in the studio to vibe to the beat because that's, you know, obviously that's a waste of money.
So
the moment we got there, the moment we get there, we're like, here's the reel to reel, load it up. This is the song, lay it down. While the engineer is laying down and maybe tweaking some of the sounds on the song, we probably on a corner somewhere rehearsing what we're about to do in the sound booth. At the end, don't even worry about mixing it down. You want it like a rough mix for you to take with you to see if you needed to come back again to change something or lay something down again. But you never wanted a perfect mix either, because the next day the mix was going to sound totally different to your ears.
Yeah.
You know, when you bang your ears all night and it sounds wonderful, the next day it sounds like crap. So you're like, you know, you got to go either go back in and redo it or whatever. But
so at this point, were you trying, when you went into the studio, you know, laying down tracks or whatever, were you trying to put together an album? Were you trying to put a project together, or this was just for various, you know, different projects that had nothing to do with each other?
Well, at that time, I was trying to put a project together. There were also times where Howie T or someone would call me and say, I have a group from L.A. that needs a verse in the middle of this song or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, there were several times with the way I had to do that. And I would go in the studio unprepared because that wasn't, it's their studio time.
Yeah.
Actually, let's say you're the artist and Universal is your record label. Universal is paying the whole bill, but eventually you're going to pay for it because that's coming out of your budget.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Say you became a rap artist. Universal gave you a contract. Your contract is worth $250,000. Everything is coming out of that $250,000. They may not tell you that, but when you do a show in Miami and you stay at this hotel and you ate at this store, whatever it was that you did, and you took a cab here because you forgot something and took it back, all that's coming out of your budget. Believe me, somebody is taking all those receipts and all that money that they're giving you. Eventually, it's going to come out of your budget.
Right.
Your video, you know, somebody may tell you, go with this $30,000 video, and you may say, I want the $50,000 because it looks better. That's going to come out of your budget. Right. And a lot of people don't know that. There's a lot of young kids today that think that they can just go in and become famous. There's so much to it that I'm kind of upset that people don't teach the kids. You know what I mean? Because you just like grabbing a kid and having them believe that they're going to be famous when really they're going to be in debt.
Yeah.
So basically what you're saying is that, say Universal, you keep saying Universal. Universal goes, hey, we're giving you $250,000. They give you the $250,000, but they're not giving you that money yet. They're giving you, you're doing the tour, you're going to stay in a hotel, you're doing this, you're doing that. So at the end, at the end of all this, they subtracted all this out of that $250,000, so you may end up with only like $30,000 after total, after all that. Is that what you're saying? Like, that's what they use that for?
Right. Like, yeah.
You end up in debt, so you use
it. Well, yeah, you end up making or losing money, right?
Yeah, what's going to happen is when your record comes out, everything that sells is going to go back to the company until they recoup everything they lend you.
Yeah.
So it's like
unless it goes above and beyond, then you don't get anything.
Yeah, you may get money from tour here and there, little things here and there, but you're not going to get much. You know, everything is going back.
So their base, the contract is really just front. It's a front. They're fronting you the money.
Yeah, they're fronting you the money.
That's all that is. They want that back.
And you better know how to work it to where you can give them the money back and then you still make some.
Yeah. Right.
But the kids are not thinking about that. They're thinking I'm going to be famous and that's it. They're not thinking, okay, I'm going to sit down with my company and we're going to come up with a nice logo. Say Hector Velez is the artist. All right. So we're going to come up with the hats, with the jackets or with the wristbands or whatever. But we're going to make it nice so people can buy it. We're going to make some pink ones for the girls so the ladies can buy them.
Yeah.
The kids are not thinking about any of that. Yeah. They're just thinking, I'm famous. and I shot a video, everybody knows who I am. They're not thinking, you know, they're not thinking, I have to make sure that these hats sell so I could pay off this money so then I could start making money. You know what I mean? It's so much deeper than just that. That's just like
the surface.
The beginning.
Yeah, I saw a special on the rapper Pitbull based out of Florida.
Is he a rapper, Pitbull?
Or is he... Well, he, let's just say the artist. He started off as a rapper. He was a hardcore hip-hop rapper. Like he was a drug dealer rapper is what Pitbull was. And then he smartened up kind of what Eric is talking about. And it was back, it was in 2009. And the only reason why I know this is because I just watched this documentary about 2 weeks ago. And in 2009, it was when his old contract, either it was over or the company like called it off and he jumped onto a new contract. But anyway, he was talking about being knowledgeable. He's like, being an artist is one thing. He's like, that's actually probably 10% of it. 90% of it is the business aspect that what Eric is saying no one talks about. He's like, you know how many talented people there are? He's like, go to your church. You'll see a very talented singer. Yeah. But they don't have the business aspect. They don't know how to run the business part of it. They don't know how the marketing works. They don't have none of that, how to maintain a budget. He was talking about I guess it was a contract that he had or entered. He's like, this is the stuff that you don't think about, right? So they say, we're going to give you album sales, right? The physical album sales. So whatever we sell, let's just say you get 1% of total sales, okay? This is just an example. I don't know how the numbers work. Yeah. It's just say it's 1%. And then when you go on tour for each show, we're charging, you know, for whoever wants to, you know, bring you to their city, it's $50,000. You get 10 grand. Okay, great. Fantastic. He's like, here's the thing. He's like, my album came out, right? And I'm only mentioning two things that you make money off of. I'm sure there's like a boatload of other stuff that they, you know, potentially could make money off of. Yeah. His album came out. All this, you know, album sales are going crazy through the roof. Guess where they made the most money off of? And he had no idea because he was not, you know, thinking in that direction. It was streaming. So this is when streaming came out. Oh, so his digital sales were crushing it. And he was like, well, where's all my album money at? And they're like, well, we basically made it all. We knew streaming was going to be big. And they weren't allowed. They weren't putting that into contracts at that point.
No. Yeah.
It was too early in the game because they were basically testing.
So he wasn't making money off?
He wasn't making money. No money off any.
Off anything that was streamed?
Anything that was streamed.
Oh, damn.
Yeah. It was something to that extent. I don't know if that's specifically what it was.
Right.
It was something like that. But it's kind of what Eric's saying. You don't know. It's business. That it's the music business point where a kid is just enthralled with being, quote, famous. Right. When really they're just being used by a company and they're just being exploited.
Yeah.
So what other, you know, so you're at the point where just kind of take us back one more step. So where do you go from there? When you had all the studio time and you're, you know, Howie T's calling you in, doing some shows or dropping down
some lyrics
into, you know, songs and jumping on other albums. Where do you go from there?
So now, you know, this is the 90s. Obviously, I'm trying to do as much work as I can. I mean, not only do I love music, but also we need money. So
yeah,
I'm working. I'm chasing labor. A lot of times you do some work and you don't see the money until you actually walk up to the record label and you kind of like sit there until they cut you a check. Or tell you, okay, the check is going to be at your house in 3 days. 3 days go by, you back at the label again, like, where's my check? That's why you hear stories of people running up to the buildings and the labels and like with a baseball bat and tearing up all kinds of awards and platinum records.
That's
and, you know,
crazy.
It's because they give you a hard time for your money. You know, they give you a hard time. So this is still part of the 90s. I think I told Hector this also. One of the times that I remember clearly also that I've never spoke to anyone about in an interview or anything like that was going up to a studio, Quad Studio in Manhattan. and we were basically about to we were going to record a song with Tupac. So Howie T, again, it was Howie T. Howie T called me. He said, we're going to do a song with Tupac. And the song was Little Sean's. I don't know if you guys know who Little Sean is, but Little Sean he's also a ghostwriter. He wrote for other people, but also he wrote for himself. Actually, Biggie mentioned Little Sean in one of his songs. What's the song? I don't remember. Oh, Party and BS. I don't know if you remember that song. It's an old Biggie song, but he mentioned Little Sean on the song. And Little Sean was always in the cyphers with us, and he liked my style. So he used to tell me, one day we're going to do a song. I'm going to take you in the studio. We're going to do a song. So I get the phone call from Howie, and Howie was like, Little Sean and Pac want you on this song. I truly don't know if Pac knew I was going to be on the song, but that's what he said. So I was like, I'm there.
Yeah, hell yeah. So we run to that.
Me and my man, Indian, we headed to the studio in Manhattan, and we sat in the studio, we listening to the music, you know, and we, you know, talking and writing. Quad Studio is three floors. So in one of the floors, Biggie was recording. So it was like the whole Junior Mafia. Junior Mafia was recording. I don't know what they were recording. But the other floor was SWV. So SWV is in one studio. Wow. Yeah, and actually Puffy was there, and Andre Harrell happened to be there. Andre Harrell, I think at the time he was either Puffy's right-hand man or something. I don't remember clearly. But and then the third studio was where Little Sean, myself, and Pac were going to be. So we in the studio, we waiting, you know, we waiting. We go down to the store for a minute. We get something to drink, come back up. And next thing you know, Pac comes out of the elevator. This is like the second or third floor. But Pac comes out of the elevator, but he's bleeding. He's like bleeding. He's got blood pouring out his face. And so people start rushing everywhere. Little Sean pulls up a chair for him. He's like asking them all kinds of questions. And Pac is basically saying, I can't believe they did this to me. This was the first time that he actually got shot. When he got shot five times going into the studio. I don't know if you guys read that.
Yeah, no, I remember that story. Yep.
That was the first time.
Yeah.
And the way it happened was,
that's what kicked off the war.
Somebody waited for him to go in the elevator, and they shot him in the elevator, and luckily he happened to come out of the elevator with his life still. So he sat down. While he sat down, some of the people in his crew are going crazy. Basically, like, if my boy dies, everybody in here is dying. So, you know, we're like, man, you know, everybody is like, first of all, you're concerned because one of hip hop's best artists is shot up. And he's right there in front of you. You're like, what's going on?
Right.
So now they're talking about the cops are getting ready to come up to the studio. So everybody's taking their piece out and hiding them somewhere. People were sticking pieces in the piano, you know, behind the water heater, everywhere. People were just like getting rid of whatever they had on themselves. This time, I don't know if you guys know, but he was already having trouble with the law, where he was, you know, basically being parked. I think he had trouble with two cops in Atlanta where he stepped out of the car and actually, like, they had, like, somewhat a shootout from what I heard. So the cops already, they didn't like him. They didn't like Pop. And he had a court date coming up, the rape charge.
Yeah.
So, you know, so here comes, the cops came in. The cops are asking people for ID, this and that. In the meantime, they're kind of, like, waiting for this guy to bleed to death because they're not even calling an ambulance or they, you know, they not doing what you would normally do when somebody got shot.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And they're like, so how's it hanging, Pac? Who did this to you? You know, all these questions so calm and you're not even calling an ambulance for the dude. So
yeah,
that's crazy. They're dragging it along.
Yeah. So make that long story short, the ambulance finally came. There's so many stories about it, about maybe it was Bad Boy, maybe it was Biggie.
So that's crazy. So you're like, you know, in this fascinating time of hip hop, where the two of hip hop's legends were in the middle of their whole career, and to make it even, you know, more interesting, you're basically part of hip hop history when, you know, Pac got shot five times in the elevator, and so you're a part of this. So I remember, you know, in the beginning of this interview, you said, "I am hip hop," but, and you were referring to one thing, and like, the more you talk, it's like, it's almost you're watching, or I feel like I'm listening to hip hop itself unfold, like the birth of hip hop, maybe not the birth, but like the adolescence almost of hip hop.
Some of it. I've seen a lot backstage, seen a lot through my walk, and because I, like I said before, I love it. So when there's information about it, I want to know because I love it. This is something that I grew up with. This is something that I want to see. I want to see it more in a positive light than a negative.
Yeah.
Right now it's very difficult, but things come around. Yeah. Things come around. You know what I mean?
So it's like my daughter, she wanted us to get shell tops for Christmas. Shell tops been out for how long now? Shell tops are old. I had shell tops.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, shell tops are old, and they're bringing these things out like if they're the new Jays that just came out or something. Like, they make it seem like they started something new.
Yeah.
They don't realize that they've been out for so long.
Yeah. And it happened with music, you know? It's like we were in the 90s, nobody could tell us anything because we were sampling all these sounds and the music was great. We were actually, as you know, we were taking sounds from our parents.
Yep.
Yeah.
You know, so it was coming back around. Yeah. We were using it again in a different way, in a more modern way.
Yeah.
But it was the same thing they were doing. You know, they didn't like all of it. Just like today, I don't like a lot of the hip hop that's out today. But I remember my dad, how he was. So I don't want to be the same way, and I want to give it a chance, and I want to understand today's hip hop.
Yeah.
You know, knowing that there is positive, there is negative, but there's also positive. And what can we do to make the positive stand out front and not so much the negative of it?
So if you know, trying to understand the kids today, and I think there's also an effort for the kids today trying to understand the generation before them.
Mm-hmm.
And in that conversation that you would have with someone, what would be, there's two part, who was your favorite, you know, looking back now, 90s artist, you know, aside from yourself, or aside from, maybe it's someone that the world doesn't know. And also with that, how would you explain the 90s era to the new generation?
The 90s, wow. It was very creative, because we took so many different things to come up with one thing.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? It's like we took a record, we took a sample or two or three out of that record. We made it sound slightly different, or we purposely made it sound the same way our parents did it, but we threw a boom bap on top of it.
Yeah.
To make it ours. I don't know if that's a good explanation of it, but you know, like that is like,
I feel like the process, even just thinking about that, the process was different. You talking earlier about the whole copy and paste thing, there's more involvement with the development of getting one, I guess, track put together when it comes to, you know, even just generating ideas about it and then physically putting it together, where nowadays, literally, I'm in my home office and I could probably record an entire album. Now, it would probably not be to the best quality or whatever, but we have the tools at our fingertips right now that someone like me who has no background or whatever, I can easily, you know, do it. What they call, he just Pro Tools his whole album, whatever. Yeah. It's almost like a joke. Whereas before, I feel like the hardcore process of literally that still amazes me, the copy and paste thing.
Yeah. It was a way more in-depth effort you had to put towards to even make something that sounded good.
So when the end product came, I'm sure you guys appreciated it much more.
Yeah. Now, I was going to say, another good example of that is today, anybody can DJ today.
Yeah.
You know, before, we had to listen to a song and then picture, well, that's the way I used to do it. I will play a song and I will picture the next song in my head that may go well with the song that I'm playing.
Gotcha.
So I will pull that song out and either I'll slow it down or sped it up a little bit to match the next song before I bring it into the mix.
Right.
Today, you have like virtual DJ and all these tools where you could take two songs and it's going to tell you what the beats per minute of that song is.
Yeah.
So you can't go wrong. It's like it's there.
Yeah,
and if the beats per minute is different than the song you just placed, there's a button that can automatically slow it down to the exact tempo of the other one.
Wow.
When before we had to manually, we had to go in the crate and find the song that you want. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
it's not like, crates. Oh, I'm gonna do search and I'm gonna type.
I'm gonna Google.
You know what I'm saying? It was totally different.
You had to really know the songs. Like you had to legitimately understand.
You had to know the artist, know the song, and think about that
and
beat
know where
behind
on
it.
The record it was at.
And know especially knowing the records. Yeah. So you had to pinpoint that.
And then remember that we had to, as a DJ, you have to go to the party and you have to carry 2-3 crates because these were records. You're not carrying a briefcase with MP3s.
Yeah.
You're now carrying all these records and you got to go back and forth with those and you got to keep an eye on anybody trying to snatch your records while you're digging into this one crate. I mean, it was so involved.
Yeah.
You know, thinking about it today is like, man, this kid's got it easy.
What
so do you have an artist that you you would say or maybe two or three that you say embodied that hard work that or that you think of the 90s and you're like, that dude, he was the man. And it doesn't have to be anyone that was famous. Maybe it's someone that no one knows.
Yeah, I know a couple of artists that no one, I'm not going to say no one knows, but people hardly know them, that are very, very good at what they do. One of my friends that I told you from Philadelphia, his name is J. Cole. The way he writes, it's like he always told me, always make the next song better than your last song. You know what I mean? And I always do that. Even if the song doesn't turn out to be better than the last one, at least I know that I put that effort.
Yeah.
To make it better than the last one, and he taught me that, and more than style and lyrics, I like that about an artist that can give you information that's going to take you further, you know what I mean? Like that's advice that today I give artists that ask me for advice. I always tell them, you know, make your next song better than your last one, because that alone. You have to work. You have to think and you have to work. How am I going to make this song better than the last one?
Right.
Especially like the song is yours and you know that's your baby. So you're like, you're rocking that song. That's my song, man. That's hot. And now you got to go to the studio and make one better than the song that you know is hot.
Right.
And you know it's the joint. So that's, you know, that's one of the things that I say to kids. But as far as artists that are out today, or that out in the 90s and still here today or whatever.
Yeah.
I like Kool G Rap. I like Rakim. I like Slick Rick. And one of my favorite artists is Redman.
Nice.
Redman is like, to me, is so underrated, man. But Redman is just Redman to me. Like he's also, I think he took a page from Slick Rick about storytelling. Even though storytelling might not have been like a clean or what you expected, but it came from what he felt, and it was written well. So I kind of like dig his music a lot. Artists today, like I go back and forth with Hector to find out what's going on today because I'm not in touch with a lot of the new stuff today.
Yeah.
But, you know, obviously, like, you know, with him, we go back and forth with, like, what Drake is doing or what Kendrick Lamar is doing. You know what I mean? Like, just recently, I called him over to my desk, and I was like, yo, check this kid out. Anderson .Paak. Remember we heard that? And Anderson .Paak is, like, nice. So the music is not totally lost. It's just what people choose to give you, what people choose to feed you. Yeah. You know, it's all you're gonna know. But if you take time to research yourself, or you know, you're gonna find so many artists that are so nice that may not even have like one download.
Yeah.
But are like awesome artists. You know, so there's a lot of artists that I get inspiration from.
All right, so to wrap this up, for someone just getting started in the music industry, what are the first things they should know to understand before even beginning? Maybe there's just advice to, you know, like a younger person just entering into the music industry. What you mm-hmm. if you were their mentor, if you were their coach, what would you tell them?
The first thing I will tell them is do it because you love it. Because if you don't love it, you're not going to do it right, and you're not going to do it long. Mm. So why do it if it's something that's like, I'm only going to do it for a year or two or whatever.
Kind of like a phase. You know,
our dream when we grow up, when we say I want to be a doctor, we don't say we want to be a doctor because we want to be a doctor for 2 weeks or a year.
Right.
You want to be a doctor. So if you really, you know, you want to waste your time asking me, you know, like, how should I go about this? The first thing I'm going to say is do it because you love it.
Yeah.
And then after that, a lot of things are going to go your way because you love it. For example, you know, if somebody tells you that song stinks, okay, it may stink. You're going to take that advice or you're going to listen, or you may know better and know that it doesn't stink, but you're going to continue because you love it. They're not going to tell you something that you're going to go, oh man, forget it. I ain't doing this no more.
Yeah.
You love it. That's why today I still do music today.
Yeah.
Because it's something that I love being creative and coming up with different things, kind of like writing a small book or telling a little story or whatever. But, you know, at the end of the day, I'm like, man, I did that. Thank you, God, for allowing me, you know what I mean, for giving me the talent to be able to complete a song. You know, not too many people can say that.
Yeah.
Not too many people can say I wrote that book, or, you know what I mean, I wrote this speech.
Yeah.
You know, so, I mean, you have to love it. Second, I think they got to copyright everything they write. You have to get it. You got to copyright. It's easier today. Back when I was coming up, everything that I wrote, I would take to the Library of Congress in D.C. because I was in D.C. anyway. So I would get on the bus or I would drive to the Library of Congress and get everything copyright.
Wow.
And the way you do it, a lot of people, oh, but it costs so much money. Well, if somebody steals it, you're not getting any money.
Yeah.
Okay. So cover it right.
So get it copyright. You don't have to do one song. Like they'll charge you $30 for a song. But if you do something like, I forget what they call it. It's not a bundle, but it's a bundle where you, let's say you do a whole compilation, you can pay, let's say, $40. So instead of paying $30 for one to copyright one song, you know, pay $40 and do 50 songs.
Yeah.
And 50 songs will be one title.
Yeah.
You know, it'll be like Eric's songs or whatever. And boom, you just, you know, so today that's what I do. Today is a lot easier. Today I can go to copyright.com and get my songs copyright. But those are two things that I feel that an artist has to do, and it'll make life a lot easier for them because some people want to kill people for their music. So.
Sure.
So copyright, so you don't have to kill anybody for your music. You can sue them.
Solid advice. So make sure you're passionate, do it because you love it, and get your stuff copywritten. And that's just two pointers that we received at the tail end of this episode with that was explosive with storytelling, memories, and the real game of hip-hop. And this guy is a wealth of knowledge. And I think we're probably going to have to have you on again, because I'm just like fascinated with these stories here, and I'm sure you haven't even scratched the surface of, you know, what you can tell us. Yeah, so fantastic episode. That was very interesting, and I have like 400 questions that popped to my head like as you're talking, so we would definitely have to get you on again. But all right, so how can people reach you or follow you, or if someone had questions, you know, wanted to, you know, pick your brain for some advice or whatever it may be, wanted to connect with you, how can they connect with you?
They can find me as The Foreigner almost in everything, Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter.
Okay.
DAFOREIGNA, The Foreigner. At times I go by Waka Bim Bam only because that's Waka is like a Waka Clan is a crew of different artists and different, I don't even want to say just artists because it's like DJ artists, lawyers from Panama, and Everyone has a name Waka in front of it, and it was way before Waka Flocka Flame or way before he came out, there was a Waka Clan in Panama. So they call me Waka Bim Bam. So at times you can find me as Waka Bim Bam, B-I-M-B-A-M, or The Foreigner on pretty much anything out there. I have songs on iTunes under The Foreigner, songs on, what do you call it, Spotify. I mean, you name it, you know, I'm out there. I'm not a top artist, but my stuff is still out there. And right now, my main focus is just trying to do. I'm really trying to find a kid that's nice that I could write for, like really nice.
Yeah.
Like, you know, but more of a. It's kind of difficult finding a kid with their head well placed. You know what I mean? It's very difficult. So, but if I could do that one day. Because I feel like I can write every day. There's times where I wake up. I think I told Hector, I could wake up from a dream and remember half of a verse that I heard in the dream. I remember I had a dream. I was watching somebody perform. And I remember what the person said in the performance in my dream.
Wow.
So I wrote it down. So is that considered me biting somebody's style, or is it my own style because it was my dream?
No, because he didn't copyright it. That's awesome. So let's wrap this episode up. We like to wrap it up with quotes, and of, you know, appropriately, we have Tupac and Biggie quotes. So the first one's by Tupac, and it goes like this: "My mama always used to tell me, if you can't find something to live for, you best find something to die for." And then the Biggie one goes like this: "How real can your music be if you wake up in the morning hearing birds and crickets? I never heard birds when I wake up. Just a lot of construction work, the smell of Chinese takeout, children screaming, and everybody knocking a different track from Ready to Die as they pass down the street."
Listen to his own track.
Yeah. All right, awesome. So this episode titled Music to My Ears. In this episode, we had special guest producer, writer, Eric Harris, a.k.a. The Foreigner. We discussed the music industry, the business, music from the 90s, the importance of having good lyrical content, producing music, the new era versus the old era, our favorite 90s artists, and advice for someone just getting started in the music industry. We wrapped the episodes up with quotes from Notorious B.I.G. and Tupac Shakur. All right, so in exiting this episode, Eric, you're gonna you know, walk us out of this with a freestyle, or what's up?
Yes, yeah, I wanna kick some for you since you were talking about Biggie and Tupac's quotes. A lot of my stuff, my music is kind of like full of quotes at times, and I just wanted to just rock one verse, and I'm going to do one in Spanish and English because that's who I am. And he goes, I was born in the slums of a central American country, and my mental reacts and attacks an instrumental, just like I did abuelita's rice and lentil. Dame un momento y de una vez aclaremos que esto no es un demo, ya se lo publicaremos mundialmente. The world's gotta hear it. Louder than a bomb, you really don't gotta be near it. Oh no, a village did not raise me, but my neighbors knew the flavor that embraced me. San Joaquin, Marañón, La Librada, Barraza, cualquier terraza, cualquier parada. Panamá, nada más que cuna de campeones. Matemáticos llegan y suman mis canciones. Disarray, whoever rhymes my way. Lock, load, explode, bombs away. Bim bam ism, form of terrorism. When they see my pick, they say that ism. Dudes hate them, girls kiss them. Daddy gave me music, mommy gave me wisdom. I ran with it, did it my way like Frankie. You don't have to love me, but I think that you should thank me. No soy pionero, pero pregonero, espero. Todo hoy no quiero, nada cuando muero. Un minuto de silencio para el difunto. Waka Trouble, Waka Nati, ahora tan juntos. See you soon, I'm always rocking your tunes. When my neighbors hear the boom coming out of the room, they either finger snap, toe tap, or clap. Nobody there disturb when I fall into the gap. Mi país, mi bandera, mi familia. Se lo debo a Dios. You can keep the memorabilia. That's it.
Yeah.
There he is.
That's just a quick snippet.
That's a quick snippet. I like that.
That's dope.
Beautiful. All right. So there you have it, folks. Eric Harris, a.k.a. The Foreigner. I love it. Well, that wraps up this episode of the Rotated Views podcast. Thanks again for joining us. Guys, don't forget to visit the website, JimmyLeeVelez.com. Follow the blog. If you have any inquiries or questions you would like for us to answer on a future episode, just email us at info@JimmyLeeVelez.com. And on behalf of myself and the rest of the crew, we wish you massive success. And until next time, adios.
The Rotated Views podcast was produced for self-development purposes. Thank you for the love and support. We truly do hope you enjoyed the views.